Our this week's parsha is Parsha Shlach, which is the tells the amazing story of Moshe dispatching 12 spies to spy out the land. They come back, they bring a bad report, and a disaster ensues where the Jews are then, as a punishment, stuck for 40 years. That's the 10-second summary, but we're going to go in deep. But we're going to begin with, first of all, the title that I'm picking is Parsha Shlach, Try Not, Do or Do Not, There Is No Try. Okay, for 500 points in the square, who said that phrase?
Yoda.
All right, Scott Shapiro, that's Yoda. Okay, so we're going to, this is a... This
I would
is,
like to think that he would be a good Torah sage.
Absolutely. So we are, this is the first time in 5.5 years of a weekly Parsha class where I have showcased literally hundreds of TV, movie, and other video clips, first times for Star Wars. We've done Harry Potter. We've done all the classics. It is time for Star Wars. So all my Star Wars lovers out there, we're going to go one of the epic scenes with, I'm going to set up the movie. Of course, we're going to set it up. A clip that probably does not need a setup, which is that Luke Skywalker is learning to be a Jedi Knight. And who is training him? Yoda, of course, who is in fact a Jedi Knight. And is educating him in the ways of the Force. That's the scene. I'm going to do the old share screen. And we are going to, we're going to get into that. Okay, bear with me as we switch to do a little share screen. Okay, you heard the little, okay, let's do this. Share screen. Boom. 1 second, hold on, I want to make sure I get the volume. Okay, yep, and here we go. Here we go.
Get it out now.
So certain are you. Always with you, what cannot be done. Do you nothing that I say?
Master, moving stones around is one thing. This is totally different.
No different. Only different in your mind. You must unlearn what you have learned.
All right, I'll give it a try.
No. Why not? Do or do not. There is no try.
Possible.
right. There we have it. All right, that's a classic scene. Yoda with Luke, who he's educating him the ways of the Force. And Luke tried to lift up the sunken ship and failed. And Yoda, a 3-foot Jedi, able to lift the ship out of the swamp and transport it to dry land. Okay, so let's get into it. Number one, what advice did Yoda give Luke?
To, you know, don't just try to do something, do it. Don't, like, half-ass it. Like, give, like, 100%.
Right. Do or do not, there is no try. Okay. All right. Now, okay. So, of course, that begs the question is, why does Yoda not believe in trying? What is his assumption? And there's no trying? Why is there no trying in his worldview? Why is there no trying? Either you do it or you don't do it. There's no trying. Why is there no trying?
I think it might be more by committing. Like, I remember when I was a goalkeeper, and there's a loose ball between me and the forward. As a goalkeeper, I had to decide whether to go out of the goal.
To commit?
And I try to win the ball or stay in the goal. But, like, if I went and then I came back, then I would, you know, that wouldn't be good at all. Because then I would just be in a bad position and, you know.
You gotta fully commit.
So Adrian bring up one. I think there's one. That's one idea, which is that basically, sometimes if you do something in a halfway manner, what happens is you don't accomplish. You don't get the benefit of remaining in your initial position, like in a sports situation, or the benefit of not investing your energies. And by not committing, you don't get the job done. So you get the worst of both worlds. Right. That's one idea, but I think his thought is deeper than that. I think what you're saying is true, but there is more. What is his assumption? Yoda is working with an assumption about accomplishment in general.
It's kind of like that he has to have, like, faith in himself to just know that he can do it, not just try to do it and be like, if you fail, it's okay. No big deal. Like,
yeah, but so what? So, yeah, Scott, you're on the right road. Go further. What is Yoda assuming? Now, again, it's based upon his worldview about the Force, which we'll get into a little more deeply.
That if you don't really commit yourself fully to the task, like, you won't get the full benefit of, like, the power or, like, the knowledge.
That's true, but why is that true?
Because it's white or black. I think it's more like he doesn't even look at grades of grade. It's like, seems to be the operating assumption of his mindset is like a dichotomous relationship. You're either doing it the best you can or not at all. Like, it seems like he doesn't even look at the space in between.
Yeah, why is he involved in what they call black and white thinking based upon his worldview? Now, you got to know a little bit about Star Wars.
Good versus evil, light versus dark kind of thing.
Okay, that's part of it. But what's the philosophy? I'm going to insert a question here. What is his philosophy, which he articulated about the Force? What is the Force? How does it operate? You know, obviously it's a science fiction movie, but what's his belief?
It's all around us. It flows through us. It binds us.
So what is it?
it's like a like a like a like a power.
What is the source of the power?
Well, technically, based on the new movies, they call it the midichlorians.
All right, but that's before.
Don't like that.
Right, that's already adding. That's a mechanism, but basically, in Jedi thinking, if I have seen all the movies, as best I can understand, is that the Force is the energy of the universe. In order for you to be able to, and a Jedi gains power by channeling the Force, the good Force of the universe, right? George Lucas did was rather intelligently, and the people who helped him, he took a number of philosophies. This is more the good, you know, the Force. And the dark side is very similar to the belief of Zoroastrianism, which is a belief that, you know, still exists today, but was much more prevalent. Actually, it's what the non-Jewish Persians believed in when the Jews lived in Iran and Iraq in the time of the Talmud. That was the Zoroastrianism, is that the world is broken up by two forces, the force of good and the force of evil. And they're constantly in battling. So what Yoda is saying, that you can do everything if you are going to, in an unimpeded way, commit to have the Force flow through you. But if you are hesitant, if you are, quote-unquote, trying, it's not going to work. You know what I'm saying? You have to be able to be a conduit for the power of the universe. What he calls the Force, the life force of the universe, okay? So therefore, if you're going to just try and not fully commit, as Scott said, you're not going to be able to channel the energy, okay? Now, so what is the limits? What are the limits of that thinking?
No gray.
What?
There's no gray area. It's like a threshold sort of thing where, like, unless you're doing it perfectly, you're not going to get the impetus of the universe at all. It's like this threshold type of thinking.
True. What else? What else do we got here? What other limitation is there in this line of thinking? Or what is some or link or limit in this type or in his assumption?
You're not going to just be able to get the full force of the power.
Okay, but so you're basically agreeing with that. So question, but since we don't live in a Star Wars world, what is limiting about that thinking? In other words, there's a part of that thinking which is correct, and there's a part of that thing which is incorrect.
Well, there's a merit give up. Of it.
Say it again?
The merit part of it, whether something is good or bad, and whether trying is good or bad. And it's sort of in this like good and bad universe where there's good energies and bad energies, trying is obviously bad. Because the force, the good force, is not flowing through you.
So what's the limit of that that perspective?
That somebody won't get better or stronger by trying. You know what I mean? Kind of like building up
their strength. Now, what is the assumption of trying?
That you'll fail and that you'll learn from your failure.
Yes. And what else? You're correct. What other is? It's also assuming that your being better or worse has to do with the assumption that the universe somehow, the energy of the universe, is aligned with you. Well, that's not necessarily true. Okay. In other words, in other words, when a person has success, it's not because he's aligned himself with the energy of the universe. That's the scientific. That's the science fiction. In other words, the idea of the Force is not apparently true. We don't have Jedi Knights. Okay, so you could, even if you fully commit, you can fail. The point is not being, it's not in other words, just being all in doesn't always mean you're going to be successful. You could do everything within your power, but it doesn't mean that the universe works through you. That may not be how the world works. Okay, so there's a positive to what Yoda said, and there's a negative. The positive is that in general, we are often, what he's also bringing to bear is that oftentimes that what limits us in any parts of our life, in our relationships, in our business and professional activities, is our own beliefs. In other words, we have a certain small, narrow vision of ourselves and what we can accomplish. But if we, what they call, raise our sights, we can accomplish a great deal more. You know what I'm saying? In other words, we make our own limitations. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, by fully committing, and is an opportunity to be successful by trying, and as Scott said, also failing. But the negative part is that we're not, even if you are going to be successful or not going to be successful, it's not going to be based upon the energy of the universe surging through you. That's not how the world seems to operate. You know what I'm saying? But in Star Wars world, that's how the Jedi Knights are able to do unbelievable physical feats, is because they are operating as the conduit of the power of the life force of the universe. That does not seem how the world operates. So, on one hand, do or do not, there is no try. That kind of thinking can be helpful when you're not going to be sort of like getting in your own way. In other words, you do it, you commit, you put all energy in, and you do the best you can. That's it. There's a value to that. Now, but there is a point of trying, recognizing that, hey, I have certain limitations. The world operates based on the way that it does. And even if I, it doesn't mean I'm going to be successful. So we don't live in the Yoda world, okay?
But I have a question.
Yeah, shoot.
Robert, you're sort of saying that if you try the best, that the limitations you impose on yourself are not going to be an issue. But is that actually the case? Like if we say, like, I can do 100, and you can really do 500, then you're going to get to 100 and you're going to be like, I did the best that I could. So like the own framework that you impose on yourself will limit what you consider to be your best effort.
So 100% correct. But if a person says, let's say a person says, I could do 100 push-ups. And let's say they could do 500. So right, so therefore saying you can only do 100 is limiting yourself. But a person says, I could do 50,000. Well, that's, it's not true. You know what I mean? There is a limitation. You know what I mean? There are limits. Now, those limits are oftentimes far more than we imagine. And that's where Yoda's line of thinking is helpful. You know what I'm saying? But there is an idea of a trying, because the world does not operate based on the way that there's a force. I don't know if I'm making myself clear, but we're gonna see an application of that in our parsha, interestingly enough. But just before I get into, let's just understand what we're talking about here with Yoda's idea. There is an idea of trying, because I recognize that I don't have, Now, by the way, there's trying in a robust way, recognizing that I don't have the power to accomplish everything. You know what I'm saying? There is a half-hearted try, which in general, as Scott pointed out, is rarely going to be successful. But there is trying in a successful manner. And you know what I'm saying? So there is that point where, and you recognize, look, I'm doing the best that I can, honestly and fully, but I also have a humility that I don't control the factors. And the universe is not going to necessarily help me. Okay?
Use a different word, because using the same word sort of confuses those two things. You can have, like, doing something half-assed versus doing the best that you can and not actually, like, just saying trying for the same, it's just different.
All right, so it's getting a little confused. So there is an honest, let's put it away, there's an honest initiative, personal initiative. I'm going to do this in a thoughtful and full way, but with a recognition, with a humility that I still might come up short. And then there's trying in a lame, half-hearted, self-sabotaging factor, which is rarely going to be met with success. Okay, so in general, having this attitude in many parts is a successful mindset, but it's limited, because that's not how the world actually operates. You know what I'm saying? It operates about that. There's a truth about that in a psychological realm, but not in, let's call it, in a cosmic sense. Okay, so we're going to explore this a little more. I'm going to pause here. Does that make sense? Not make sense? Am I clear? Just, you know, give me some help here.
Makes sense. I'm following you.
Okay. Okay, good. All right, so let's actually get into the Parsha here. A wild story. Great. Okay, bear with me for 1 second here. Okay. Just recognize. All right. We're gonna do a little share screen. We'll read some Sukkim to get us into the scene over here. All right. Let me share screen here. Okay, let's have... All right, so, Adrian, Mavakashah, let's read the Pesukim here.
Parashat Shelah?
Yep.
Spies Missions. Mission, exploring the promised land. God spoke to Moses, saying, send out men for yourself to explore the Canaanite territory that I'm about to give the Israelites. Send out one man for each patriarchal tribe. Each one shall be a person of high rank.
Okay, so let me pause right there. So Hashem told Moshe to send out a man who turns out to be a leader, literally a prince of every one of the tribes. So every tribe had one guy being their representative. All right? I skipped some Pesukim because I didn't want to go here all night. Keep on going. And then Moshe explains what he wants them to do. Go on.
See what kind of land it is. Are the people who live there strong or weak, few or many? Is the inhabited area good or bad? Are the cities where they live open or fortified? Is the soil rich or is it weak? Does the land have trees or not? Make a special effort to bring back some of the land's fruits. It was the season when the first grapes began to ripen.
So all right, so we have dealt with this issue every year, but I'm dealing with different topics. We're focusing on different aspects. But what I mean, this is sort of a general question: if God promised the land as a good land, why is Hashem sending the spies to, you know, determine if it's a good land? If it's a good land, it's a good land. Why do you need external verification? And if you're just having spies, send two, send three. Why are you sending 12 princes? Why not send people who are like SEAL Team 6, people who are, you know, militaristically qualified? These are people who would not think to be the people you would get us to be to be spies. We've addressed these questions in the year past. Let's see if anybody remembers or has their own idea.
It's so they can speak to their tribes, to their own people, about how nice it is down there, how safe it is.
Why did Moshe need that?
Because it's just an extra layer of, like, you know, assurances, you know?
Correct. Moshe obviously recognized that Jewish people are, as they're walking toward the border and about to get into having to do battle with the 31 Canaanite tribes, the people were getting very scared. So therefore, what he thought, as Scott brought up, and we discussed this in years past, is that he wanted that each guy, each dignitary, each important leader would go back and then sell and be sort of a cheerleader for the operation, get people psyched about it. You know, pick up their spirits. You know what I mean? Because, you know, each guy would be able to come back to their tribe and, like, get everybody psyched about it. You know what I'm saying? That was a plan. And that's why he's telling them to go and make sure they see and recognize how good the land is in every kind of way. Okay? That was the plan. All right? And let's see how it goes. All right? We go to when they come back. All right, Adrian, keep on going. You're doing a good job.
Wait, can I get it?
Yes, Chaim, go ahead.
You don't mind me asking, I totally forgot. They did fight Amalek already, right?
They once, did, yes.
And God did a miracle and he helped them, right?
Yes.
So they saw the miracles, and then they had Mount Sinai, then they had the cloud, and they have all these miracles going on around them.
That's correct.
Why are they being led by a cloud?
I can't hear you that well. You
hear me better now?
Yeah.
So they have a cloud and a fire leading them day in, day out as they're going through after they had this whole miraculous thing at Sinai.
Yes.
Why would they now have to have all this lack of faith that God's going to screw them with the land?
So that's an excellent question because... Right, this is chapter 13. In chapter 12, 11 and 12, we see an episode where the Jews, as they're approaching the land, they start to freak out. They start to complain about we need meat, and there's a whole series of problems.
Jews and food is a different story.
No, but food, it's for the same reason that we have issues with food. In other words, they needed the psychological escape into the food because the anxiety of actually having to do a full-on military campaign, was freaking them out. And you're right, Chaim. In fact, when Moshe gives them rebuke in Devarim, he lists every single thing you just said. And he says, not only that, you saw the miracles in Egypt. You know, you saw all these different miracles. All right, we're jumping...
After the split in the sea was a new level, right? That's why I was asking. So this is a new
yes,
problem.
It was. This was after everything. All right, so let's
slave mindset.
Let's see how everything falls apart. Adrian, do your magic. Go ahead.
When they arrived, they went directly to Moses, Aaron, and the entire Israelite community who were in the Paran Desert near Kadesh. They brought their report to Moses, Aaron, and the entire community and showed them fruit from the land. They gave the following report. We came to the land where you sent us, and it is indeed flowing with milk and honey, as you can see from its fruit. However, the people living in the land are aggressive, and the cities are large and well fortified. We also saw the giant's descendants there, Amalek, lives in the Negev area. The Hittites, Yebusites, and Amorites live in the hills, and the Canaanites live near the sea and on the banks of the Jordan. Caleb tried to quiet the people for Moses. We must go forth and occupy the land, he said. We can do it. We cannot go forward against those people, replied the man, the man who had gone with him. They are too strong for us. They began to speak badly about the land that they had explored. They told the Israelites, the land that we crossed to explore is a land that consumes its inhabitants. All the men we saw there were huge. While we were there, we saw the Titans. They were sons of the giant who descended from the original Titans. We felt like tiny grasshoppers. That's all that we were in their eyes. The people react. The entire community raised a papa and began to shout. That night, the people wept. All the Israelites complained to Moshe and Aaron. The entire community was saying, "We wish we had died in Egypt. We should have died in the desert. Why is God bringing us to this land to die by the sword? Our wives and children will be captives. It would be best to go back to Egypt." The people started saying to one another, "Let's appoint a new leader and go back to Egypt." Joshua and Caleb pushed back. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the whole assembled Israelite community. Among the men who had explored the land, Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh. Is it Joshua or Joshua?
Joshua, son of Nun, is Joshua ben Nun, and Caleb ben Jephunneh is Caleb.
They tore their clothes in grief. They said to the whole Israelite community, "The land through which we passed in our explanations is a very, very good land. If God is satisfied with us and brings us to his land, he can give it to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. But don't rebel against God. Don't be afraid of the people in the land. They have lost their protection and shall be our prey. God is with us, so don't be afraid." The whole community was threatening to stone them to death when God's glory suddenly appeared at the communion tent before all the Israelites.
All right, so that did not go well. That did not go well, all right? So, all right, we have a couple. All right, so let's take it step by step. All right, question number one over after the thing. When the Torah says that the princes were men, what qualities were they emphasizing? Was there a doubt of what gender was being referred to? Because he calls them men. Get men. Send out men. And then he says, send one man out from each patriarchal tribe. Each one shall be a person of high rank.
What's the word in Hebrew?
Ish.
That's not Gabriel.
No. He's asking for Anashim, an Ish. What aspect of men is he looking for from the princes? What qualities was Moshe told by God to get? What does it mean to go when somebody says you got to be a man? What is inferred by that phrase? We use that to our this very day.
You got to be courageous. You got to like put your emotions aside and do what must be done.
Correct. You got to what they call step up. You know, in fact, even the phrase even got into the vernacular as you got to man up, right? So it's all the same qualities is basically people who take responsibility, who take charge, who are going to do the right thing, people who are going to be, who despite tremendous pressure are going to do the right thing. That's what he means by he wants princes who are men. First a man, who's a prince, okay?
So all sexes.
Well, we can say the same things to be a woman, but that's who they refer. That's where the leadership was then. Now we quickly contrast to what does the statement say mean? We felt like tiny grasshoppers. That's all we were in their eyes. Show about the state of mind of the princes. How did they know what the inhabitants thought about them? What does that mean? So, Suzanne, I'm going to ask you, what does it mean that they felt like tiny grasshoppers? What were they really saying?
I feel like they were projecting their anxiety.
Correct. What is explain that? But why did it come manifest by what is a phrase like we were tiny grasshoppers?
They could be crushed by the people there. They could be taken over, and I think they still had that like that slave mentality.
Right. In other words, they didn't even describe themselves as being we're like children to them. They move themselves down to not only to not humans, not even to animals, but to and not just into insects, but what? Tiny insects. So in a sense of self on the how much sense of personal dignity and self-esteem had been punctured here. They walked out of there 6 feet tall, and they come to these people, and how tall are they now in their own minds?
Well, they're saying they're giants, right? They were giants, and we're grasshoppers. That movie.
Tiny grasshoppers.
like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Right, exactly. So the bottom line is that, as Suzanne so accurately said, this is called an example of projection. The people didn't ever say, you guys are insignificant, you guys are like grasshoppers to us. That's how they saw themselves, and imagine how those people saw them as well. They imagine that if these guys are physically powerful people, they didn't even bother with them. They're walking through their territory, and they're not even getting concerned with us because we're so insignificant, we're not even bothered taking a look at. It's like an absolute, so there's an absolute collapse of their sense of self, their dignity, the purpose of their mission, complete puncturing of their self-esteem. It's like a balloon. Just died, done, crushed. Now, let's get into it. Now we got to bring Yoda back into the Parsha. I promised you Yoda. I'm giving you Yoda. All right. What advice regarding the Force would have Yoda given the returning spies? What would he have told them?
We have to go. There is no going a little bit, poke around, and then.
Well, what did he say to Luke? What did he say to Luke about? He said a very important phrase.
Do or do not, there is no try?
No, well, he said that as well, but he said a couple of.
About the Force binding us and being all around us?
That's all. No, that's also important, but relevant to this situation.
Well, this seems to be directly analogous with that scene in that God is going to work through us.
Well, he says, size does not matter. Look at me. I'm little.
Oh,
right? Size does not matter. And I and the power is not correlated. He was essentially saying power and your capacity to channel power and to act forcefully is not related to your physical stature. He says that is a mythology. And he's fat. And then I don't know if you remember, he leans over to Luke and he pinches. I'm not impressed by this, what he calls coarse matter. He pinches his muscle. You think your muscle is really the major thing? It's not. Now there's a truth there, okay? There is a truth there. We're gonna get to that. So he would have absolutely rebuked them and said, what do you mean you're tight? In other words, he would have been unimpressed by their claims of complete surrender. Okay?
It makes me think of this book I'm reading called Sapiens. Sapiens is sort of what we are. We're Homo sapiens.
Yes.
In the animal kingdom, we are by far not the strongest.
Right.
Or fiercest of, let's call it animals, versus
yes.
Conversation. But we are the most intelligent, and through our intelligence, we're able to hunt mammoths and get to the top, to the point that we drove most animals to extinction.
Correct. So that's a good example of where that, it's as far as human force is not coming from the power that he can project out of his clenched fist. Because the reality is, he has a mind that can, you know, work out ways to, you know, kill an elephant, let's say, which is far more larger and more physically imposing than many people. So that's certainly true. Now, we're going to make it a little more spicy. Is the only thing wrong with Yoda's teaching that he views the Force as being an independent thing rather than coming from Hashem? In other words, in order to apply Yoda's teaching, take out the word Force and put in Hashem. In other words, you can just put it or add the word Hashem to Hashem Force. Would that be an accurate depiction of reality?
Yeah. God's all around us and he finds us together.
Does Hashem operate as a force? Is that the best description of Hashem?
Isn't that sort of the concept of the Shekhinah?
His divine presence, the basic meaning means what he relates to a person or people providentially, when he helps them out. But is he helping them out necessarily through a force or limited to a force?
No, it depends how you look at it. In my experience, right, it's like God's grace, right, is also considered a force in the flow. So that would be a Hashem. And there's different vernacular and different attributes. So when we take all the 13 attributes of God, right, then a lot of them are there, and it puts together this concept. Just like if we had a debate of if God created this universe and left and didn't interact right now, right, but he still created all the atmospheres, the solar cycle, the cycles, the sun, the moon, everything.
The laws of nature.
The laws of nature. So that universal laws of nature, universal force, would be the same concept. Whether it's living right now, we have a different concept as well, but...
The laws of nature, if they
universal nature, like even the laws of attraction, right, and the laws of abundance, the laws of spirituality, that's part of the laws of nature too. In that sense.
Okay, so those things emerge from him, but they're not him.
So I'm saying that's where it would depend if you called it that, right? But if we said that God created man in His image, and each person, there's a force of God in him. His image and God attributes, then as long as we're acting within the realm of God being granting us every day a neshama and every day giving us a kindness, and we go in tune with man on that, we're reciprocating and putting that force into the universe and connecting to it.
So, a good way of understanding the word God's grace or God's hashkacha is a phrase of a concept of partnering with Hashem. How do you differentiate partnering with Hashem and the and Yoda's idea of the Force?
So, I mean, Ari Bergman once spoke in MDE about a few years ago, saying this, where he basically said, like, it's all Hashem, right? It's like, either it's Hashem or it's not Hashem. Everything's Hashem, but when we act within it, it's like, you know, we do our best and God does the rest, right? So there's a point where we can't stop and we have to let go, and God's doing that part for me, filling in the gaps. At the same time, he's carrying us, doing the whole thing the entire time with his energy. He's helping us complete what we're doing.
So, all right, that is actually a grand debate within Jewish thought, which is about understanding the mechanism of partnering with Hashem. Everybody agrees with the concept that we partner with Hashem, right? The question is, what does that mean? And I'm going to give you two schools of thought, and you guys will, you know, pick what you like. One school of thought is what Chaim just described, is that the totality of existence, in a certain sense, is Hashem, and you're part of that in a sense. And Hashem is somehow apart and separate. It's called panentheism. Fancy word over there. Okay, so therefore, we are doing our best, but fundamentally, what they call, we have to do our hishtadlis, but fundamentally, God, there is, in other words, in that worldview, the laws of nature are really an illusion, because God is doing everything. He's a direct cause of everything. So you're doing actions, you do your best, but that's your obligation, but the final result will be what he produces. Really, he's doing, essentially, he's the responsible for everything. Okay? But you have an obligation to do your best. That's one approach. Okay? It's more of a Kabbalistic approach, and so that's one aspect. Another aspect is between Hashem operates the universe via the laws of nature. And one of the things that he gives us, he helps us, he partners with, is he gives us insight and help. So the way that, in this case, that the Jewish people could be successful against the Canaanite and Amori tribes of Israel is not limited to creating a big explosion and killing them all, because apparently he doesn't do that, but is giving them insight about how to strategically invade and to help them in their, you know, to make their, shall we say, bless their plan. But they must have a plan. You know what I'm saying? It's providing a insight, strategy, and motivate, and influencing the, let's call it the decision-making of the enemy to make bad decisions. You know what I'm saying? He's not, so we partner with Hashem insofar as that we make a plan that Hashem will help our plan with giving us insight that our plan will be successful and that the other people will make mistakes. Do you understand what I'm saying? But it's operating through a lawful world, or the laws of nature are not necessarily suspended. You know what I'm saying?
What about a third approach where it's like there's the laws of nature and humans, but the self is really an illusion and it's really just God doing everything?
Well, that's the first approach. The first approach is
no partnership, just God. Doubt and tell, no free will.
Well, that's not Judaism, because Judaism presupposes that either you have a minimalistic role for free will or a maximalistic role for free will. The first approach has a minimalistic role for free will. The second approach, which I'm sharing, which is a sort of Maimonidean approach, has a maximalist view of the free will. God does not, shall we say, do all the causes. There's the laws of nature. They operate in a certain way, and he provides certain help for us to make the right decision. That's that approach. But if you're going to say that God and the universe and people are just one existence, then there is no person and there is no unique will. Other than in the sense that it's akin to the old, another movie is The Matrix, where people are plugged into the Matrix and they believe they are something and they're doing something, but really they're just it's being fed experiences by the grand machine. All right, so we've gone a little far afield.
Wait, and what about another aspect, like a Jerry Maguire, where God's asking us, "Let me help you," right? To serve, you know, it's like to serve me, sort of. But there's a certain aspect that He's giving us the strength and the capabilities, and we just have to show up and do our best, and then results will happen.
Well, that of course both positions agree with. But the question is, what is the mechanism? How does that operate? Is it operating by literally a suspension of the laws of nature and God sort of like creating the net result? God's going to make everything happen? Or B, he's giving you the insight and the circumstance, but fundamentally the laws of nature are operating and you're sort of navigating the situation thoughtfully and you're sort of getting like advantages. A, the insight, and also the enemy or the competitors are being influenced to make some wrong decisions. You say it's not suddenly there's no gravity and water is being separated. It's within a lawful world, but fundamentally it's a little bit. God is not doing like literally everything.
And when we're asking and we're praying to God, where does this come in?
That's why. What's the first request? We're asking for knowledge. We're asking for the insight to be able to make the plan, to operate, to be successful. That's what we're asking for. You're asking for the insight.
And that would go according to both also, no problem.
So again, so how and both, how, what the mechanisms are, again, I have to bring in Ari Bergman to share what would be his idea of what the Baal HaTanya would say. I'm not really well versed enough to be able to answer that question, but those are good. Those are, but that is self, what we're talking about here, you know, big picture is different visions of how divine providence operate. Okay. And the major argument is, does God do everything? Or there's a, as you said before, there's a laws of nature which God set into motion. He's the cause of that, but they operate, if you will, independently. But he can help us navigate those things more effectively, more successfully, or we're just left to the chance of those laws of nature. That's getting hashkacha, getting providential help, to navigate the natural causal forces in a successful way. Either us figuring out the right plan, and B, that the other participants are influenced to be helpful to us.
So in this situation, let's just take that to sort of, if Luke or the spies, right, if they were able to just harness down their fear, right, and see that God abundance and be grateful to God and get in the light and say, we're meant to be here, right, we just need to trust a little more.
Yes.
And faith. So that would go according to, like, where does that...
Yeah, everybody agrees, no matter what position, that they had a... So, well, that gets to my next question. You've teed it up very nicely. What should the spies... Here's a key thing. They come back from their 40-day mission. Okay? What they did, they made an entire presentation to Moshe, Aaron, the entire people. But if they were feeling overwhelmed with anxieties, what should they have done?
They should have went to their leaders and say, hey, this was crazy. I'm traumatized. These guys are giants. You know, why did you send me there in the first place? Can we talk about this?
Yes, exactly that. In other words, be honest. You know, they should have, you know, said, Moshe, can we have a minute with you? Make that 5 minutes. We just came back from this 40-day trip, and I'll be honest, we're petrified. I don't see how we can even do it. Have the conversation with Moshe. Let him address their fears. Let him address their concerns. So that gets to the question. So why did they not go into Moshe's tent and share their insecurities and their anxieties? This is called classic man disease.
You're saying they went from man ish to grasshopper, less than grasshopper.
Yeah, but why? So, but why did they? Why, if they felt anxious, why didn't they go to Moshe and say, Moshe, we are completely traumatized, as Chaim said.
I think there's a different issue still, or maybe a different issue, which is going from this rationalistic school, right, where things behave according to physics and whatnot, and going from that rational empirical world into the religious world where things happen that don't necessarily make rational or, let's say, physical empirical sense. And they just decided this doesn't make sense, it's impossible, therefore God is just gonna kill us because there's no way, like in heaven, you know, that we could possibly destroy this type of nation.
No, but the question is, but why didn't they have a sense of honesty and humility to go into Moshe's tent and say, look, you sent us on this mission, we feel completely scared. Why didn't they be honest with Moshe?
It seems like it's a rush to judgment. They just arrived at the conclusion that it's impossible, therefore God must be intending to kill us because it's impossible for the world to operate within the limits, outside of the limits of physics, and to, you know,
but why was that? So if they had that question, which is, let's say, even a good question, why do they have that, or just using your phrase, why do they have that rush for judgment? Why didn't they just knock on Moshe's door and say, Moshe, we really, really need to talk to you. We've had a traumatic 40-day trip here, and we need to discuss it. And I know everybody's very excited about the year, about the land flowing with milk and honey, but honey, I got a problem. Why couldn't they be honest with Moshe? Why did they not? In fact, they didn't go to Moshe. They went. They made their declaration to the entire Jewish people that created an entire meltdown, and people went crazy and said, caused a complete panic. And the Jew says, "We can't do this." And even though the Yeshua and Caliph says they're wrong, they didn't listen to them. They said, "We got to go back to Egypt." So here's the key point that. Who were these people? These were 12 princes. 12 people who each tribe looked up to them as being, they're the men. They're the men in charge. These are men with a plan. They cannot fail. That's it. So instead of revealing their weakness and vulnerability and manning up to admit that I've tried and I failed, they went the other way. They grew more confident and more aggressive by saying, what? This plan is insane. And they did it very sneakily. First of all, they got everybody scared about these people. They start off with the truth. It's a great land. It's fertile. Look at these unbelievable grapes. Amazing. You start with, if you want to do a good lie, you start with the truth. Step one. Step two, what they do next? They says, it's great, but these people there are powerful. Step two. And even if you can overcome them in military, which is not going to happen. Three, they made up a lie. Eretz ochels es yoshveh. It's a land that consumes its inhabitants. There's something weird about this place. They start to create sort of like there's a mystical negative energy about this place. If we go there, even if we can imagine beating them, we're going down. So they had a three-stepper. First, they went with a praise. It's a great place. Problem is, too, there's these scary people there. And not only that, there's something weird about this place. It's a land that consumes its inhabitants. They could not go back to Moshe and say, Moshe, I know you want us to be the cheerleaders about the land. We are traumatized and devastated. And quite frankly, I don't think we can do it. It would create a tremendous... Sometimes you have to man up to say that I can't do it. It's being to man up or woman up to admit that I have failed. Or I can't do it. Or it's too hard for me. That takes also courage. People want to cover their inadequacies by overcompensating and saying that, no, what are you talking about? It's not me, it's you, it's or this.
The Cain and Abel story.
It's okay, correct. That's another example. Let me bring it to three. I thought of two classic MJE stories, which I'll share to you. I'm going to change the names and share how it was to apply to two common scenarios that I've come across in my 13 years at MJE. I'll read you a scenario that I crafted. An MJE named Joe had a family bar mitzvah to attend. Joe is new to kosher observance. The bar mitzvah will be a non-kosher event. He did not want to cause a fuss. Joe decides to eat the food and not say anything. Why do you think Joe, who has committed to keeping kosher, make that decision? What could he have done? Thank you. Couldn't get that out.
I mean, he could have asked if they could do like a kosher option for one.
Right. He could ask this very nicely to the people, or to say, by the way, could you ask the caterer if there's a kosher option? Or yeah, which by the way. In New York or the New York, New Jersey area is very, very common and not a big deal. A. What else?
he could have eaten before.
He could he could have done the old pregame. The pregame.
I agree with Scott. He could have totally strategized, not cause the fuss, eat beforehand, have a snack in the middle. He could always have a wedding. He could always have more vegetables, and he could always have salmon and fish or whatever sushi if he wants to play a little. Speak to his rabbi before going.
Right, he could also speak to his rabbi to get different advice about how to navigate that. So here's the question. In this case, I'm covering the guy's name up. So why do you think Joe didn't do any of that?
I have to know better, but he might have just wanted to enjoy
He's a little embarrassed.
Well, he's a person who... He's in Baton Rouge, but why so... But what about... But he's a person who
God, he missed the good food.
No, but it's not because he's not. It was
barbecue.
Right. So one possibility you say that he just saw the good food and just said, but he knew it was going to happen. But why didn't he want to call up the family, call up the caterer, deal with the rabbi? Why didn't he want to do all that?
He didn't want to make a big deal, cause a big fuss.
Why not?
Maybe his ego got into the play. He just I can do whatever I want. When I want to, I don't have to listen to other people.
Go ahead.
Kind of feel singled out.
Maybe he was just lazy.
He was lazy.
Like he's going to be at the table and he's
going to
be with cellophane.
Right. So he didn't want to. He didn't want to endure the psychological sense of being different.
Sitting at the table, everybody's eating around. He's going to get that little, tray with the plastic wrapping.
Right, with a mountain of plastic wrapping. I once had that. I was at at MJE Simcha, and it wasn't exactly kosher. So they got the kosher meal for the rabbi. That was me. So meanwhile, I'm open up this plastic. They put 47 pounds of plastic, and it's I'm opening this up there, and I'm opening it, I'm trying to chisel through this thing, and everybody's looking at me. Now, by the way, since I was a rabbi, it just made everybody feel completely inadequate, I felt bad about making, I didn't say a word, but I was giving everybody in a three table radius, a big guilt trip, because they're all Jews, they're just not eating kosher, right? So
that happened to me and my law firm's Thanksgiving dinner. The whole firm was taking out to the famous Italian restaurant in Times Square. Let's say 60 attorneys, 70 attorneys, and then the waiter comes specifically for me. Oh, are you the one that made that special kosher request? And I was signal out in front of everyone.
Right.
And then, it came with all that,
Tons of rack, right. So that's exactly what Joe did not want to do. In other words, he has a sense of self. He wants to be the cool dude. He doesn't want to cause people problems. That's a sort of a sense of dignity. And therefore, to having to be a little weird or a little bit different or put people out a little bit, he just didn't want to endure that small psychological pain. You know what I'm saying? And therefore, he just rather, it's sometimes better to go along. If you want to get along, you got to go along. So he just didn't want to deal with that whole part, even though that 364 days a year, he's now keeping kosher. He just did not want to endure that psychological pain. And he didn't want to admit to it, that he has an issue. All right?
This is completely unrelated, but what type of bracha would you say on something like this?
I can't see what that is.
It has soba noodles, avocado, rice paper, lettuce, mushrooms. I have no clue what to say.
What is it? What's it wrapped with?
It's two things.
Rice paper.
Rice paper? And what's in it is vegetables?
Avocado, hitake mushrooms, soba noodles.
Soba noodles are made out of wheat, right?
I
don't think so.
So what are soba noodles?
Hey Siri, what are soba noodles made out of? Buckwheat.
Buckwheat and wheat flours. Okay, so.
Woo!
busy.
All right, so make a shahakal on that, because it's got all kinds of stuff in there. Make a shahakal on that. All right, getting back, last scenario is another case was an MGer named Judy loves to come to MG's Wednesday night learning. She likes to discuss Kabbalah, Talmud, and other complex topics. She has scant knowledge of the Parsha or the Siddur. She doesn't want to learn those topics with her Harusa. Why do you think that's the case? And by the way, every time there's always that one person like that, male or female. And Chaim's smiling because he may have learned with some of those people. He's smiling ear to ear. All right, why do you think that, what's going on with that?
I think it's intellectual laziness.
They're intellectually lazy because they want to do the most complicated material in Judaism?
Confirmation bias, baby. Like, they're already invested in this worldview. Why jeopardize it with new knowledge?
No, but they want to deal with, they ask the Kavusa to learn the most complicated stuff. I want to learn Kabbalah. I want to learn Gemara. Every week at MG, there's always some person, and you know they don't even know what a Parshat is or how to even navigate a Siddur, but they got to go the most complicated stuff, all right? And they're not open. So the question psychologically, what's the pshat? Why don't they want to do that? I mean, there could be a couple reasons, but I want to hear.
Let me ask you something. If you want to go watch a baseball game, would you want to go to the Yankees or do you want to go to the third grade little league game? You want to get entertained. You want the wow. You want the Broadway show. You want to go to community theater. So in that aspect, you forget about the basics and how people get to places or what the 101s are. You want to get the meat and potatoes. I don't want the little gefilte fish on the side.
Right, I want the sizzle. I want the steak with the sizzle. Right. Right, but in other words, even though educationally, that's not really helping them because you can't just skip, it's like a kid saying, I want to learn calculus. Well, you don't really know algebra yet, so that's not going to help you. You know what I'm saying? They don't want, in other words, they have a certain sense of self, like either A, as Chaim is saying, they want to have the big wow conversation. And the truth is, and that might be fine, and they should be interested. But part of that is also admitting, they don't want, so they want to admit, like, I don't want to see myself as a beginner. That bothers me. In my secular life, I got a master's. I work as a distinguished professional in my industry. And now you're telling me I have to do the same curriculum as a third grader, learning what the Parsha of the week is? Now, in their mind, now obviously there's learning the Parsha as a third grader, and there's learning the Parsha in a sophisticated way. But it's something that's very, to admit that I need to do something in a preliminary way can be very painful. But reality, coming to that grip, is really holding that person back from growing so much more. And we always get in our own way. And that's where Yoda is, and I'm bringing Yoda back. Yoda is actually, from that perspective, is correct. In other words, oftentimes the limitations that we have are in our own mind, and we hold our own selves back. And what held these men back is that if they would have had the humility and honesty and recognized that they need to have a conversation with Moshe, it would have been the entire destiny of the Jewish people would have been changed. But they could not admit that. They could not admit that. And therefore they had to go as confident leaders and tell the Jewish people, you know what we need to do? This is an outrage. And they stoked a rebellion. Better to create a whole rebellion than to admit that they are lacking, that they need help.
Well, no one likes to admit that they're doing things haphazardly or that they could have done better. They draw the limitation to how much effort they put, and then they sort of like justify retroactively.
Correct. Correct. They double down on their fears instead of exploring them intelligently with Moshe. They double down and says, our perception is reality, and we got to tell the rest of Jewish people, and we're gonna make an entire revolution, and we're gonna undermine Moshe Rabbeinu, and that caused a disaster that has not, you know, that changed Jewish history for time immemorial. So the takeaway for us is that it's okay to admit that we're not perfect, that we have issues, and the act of strength is to get the help we need, admit that we have limitations, get the help that we need, and be able to be successful. And that really is and that really is the key element here. And that really is the issues that the spies grapple with and failed, but we can be better and we could be successful. And that's a message for all of us. It's not terrible to admit that we have issues and we want to deal and accept them and deal with them intelligently. Nothing wrong with that. We all have limitations, and admit to them and get help with them, and that's great. To deny them and then act forcefully that they're not there causes more damage. That's the main principle that I want to share with you tonight, and it's an honor to bring in Yoda into our conversation. So I want to wish you guys all enjoy the Parsha, and of course enjoy, and if I must say, may the Force be with you.
By the way, Rabbi, thank you so much. That was a wonderful share. And I do want to say also, there's also, your point is very well taken, and I hear 100%. I also noticed there's that aspect, like, you know, what's cool, like Madonna learned Kabbalah, right? And these people come into the thing thinking they can learn that stuff because that's what they're attracted to also.
Right.
Not 100%.
Right, because there are certain things which are sexy. Kabbalah is sexy.
Right. Mysticism.
Right. It's all the cool stuff. So, okay, 100%.
By the way, if anybody wants a virtual Myra, there's a Myra in my backyard right now. Anybody wants a
Myra, that's pretty good.
You gotta go diving.
All right, guys. So have a great night, and it was great learning with you guys. All the best.
Thank you.